welcome to episode 15 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Friday the 19th of September and I'm Tony. With me this week are Simon. Hi Simon.
Hello mate. It's been a busy one. I'm tired. I really don't want to be sat here at 11 o'clock at night, but there you go.
Yeah, we're all a little bit grumpy and you might be able to tell if you listen to the show. And also
if they listen to the show. They already are.
Please do. When you listen to the show. And that was Alan. How are you, Al?
Fine, thank you very much.
Had a busy week?
Not really.
You spent most of the day in the pub, didn't you?
Yes.
Excellent. Some of us are working.
So I'm a bit feisty this evening, that's why.
Oh.
And sorry, when you say feisty, do you actually mean annoying?
No, I mean hardy.
Okay.
And that was holiday, Dave. Back from your... Were we camping?
I was camping, yes.
Did you have a nice time?
Yes.
We did too. You weren't here. It was great.
So what have we got on the show today?
We got a right ding-dong about five a day.
And we're not talking about the pieces of fruit.
Talk about backups after a particularly disastrous session on my VPS.
We've got the news.
And, of course, feedback. And this really is a fun-packed show.
Yeah. I can't wait to get on with it.
We've mentioned a number of times that each of us hosts a mirror so that you guys, when you download a podcast, it comes from one of our setups. Now, I've been having some fun with mine.
You deleted it,
didn't
you?
I did. I deleted my VPS.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, the thing is that, obviously, David set up a nice little rsync, it's not a script, but command, to sync all the episodes. And it's great if you know how it works, but I really didn't. And, of course, it's a fairly new VPS. Why would I need to back stuff up? Because, you know, I'm still getting into it. So there I was. It was about, I don't know, 11:30 at night.
Uh-huh. Always the best time to be doing sysadmin.
Had you been drinking?
I hadn't been drinking. I'd been doing some root work, actually. And
some what work?
Some root canal. Some root canal.
Or getting rid of the grey.
I've been moving stuff around, and I was, yeah.
What
I was
pseudo
bashed.
What did you do?
And I ran the rsync script, and it deleted not only all of the podcast episodes.
That's the biggest killer.
Yeah, but, well, everything. And I saw it start deleting everything. Control-C. But it took about 15 seconds, and loads had gone. And my VPS, basically, I tried to shell back in, and I couldn't. And
because it had deleted some critical
loads,
files.
But I was still logged in, which was great.
Who needs /bin anyway?
Yeah. /etc is overrated.
And
yeah.
So I've, of course, been looking into backups now.
Stable door, bolted.
So when I do it next time, I can roll back to a backup. So come on, guys, tell me about backups.
Yeah, you need to do them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And how?
Well, the thing is, I mean, we should split into two things because quite often a lot of people get the two mixed up. There's backup and redundancy.
That's true.
Yeah.
So what's the difference, Dave?
Well, if we start with redundancy, then you've got basically if a hard drive fails, you don't lose everything.
Okay, so your data is in more than one place.
Yeah, but if you delete a file, it will then delete it off the multiple storage areas.
Okay.
So you don't keep any actual backups.
So some people would say that it's okay because I've got RAID. So isn't that a kind of backup because my data is stored on multiple disks? So
well,
I'm all right.
But that is great if one of the hard drive actually fails. If one of the hard drives kicks the bucket, then you won't lose the server and you won't lose your data.
So you've got a backup on another disk?
Yeah.
Yeah, but because it's live and because it's synced in real time, it wouldn't have helped Simon because he would have had two disks with nothing on. Identical.
So he would have had a mirror or a RAID set that had nothing on it and maybe the mirror of that having nothing on it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So RAID's really about resilience. As in, you
so
know,
suffering is fault for
hardware,
fault tolerance.
Failure, that's, yeah, fault tolerance, that sort of thing. And there are other things you can do that aren't RAID, that will help you with fault tolerance, like having your data stored in more than one place, sort of synchronized around. And there are some interesting sort of projects, one like old iFolder, which has been around for quite a few years, that are designed to do that.
Which never quite works.
No, I mean, apparently it works quite well if you're a Novell kind of customer and you have all the bits bundled in, it does work out of the box.
And there's something called Unison. Haven't you used Unison before?
Yeah, Unison is a little bit like rsync. It's like a two-way rsync. So rsync basically says all of the files on one server should be synchronized to another location, either on that server or a different server. So that's what Simon was trying to do. He was trying to sync all of the podcast files onto his server.
But unfortunately, he had the -- delete option on rsync.
Which deletes any files on the target server that aren't on the original server. Right. And if you run it in the wrong place, say the root of your file system, it goes, oh, look, all these files here. And rather cleverly, rsync does all the deletion first. before it starts syncing the data over. Unison is similar to that, except it works in two ways. So if you have a laptop, say, and a desktop, and you want to keep all of your files on both the machines at the same time, you can run Unison, and it will synchronize files in both directions.
Would that help him? Because well, surely if he was running Unison and he did rsync or rm or whatever dangerous, scary command that Simon did, surely Unison would replicate that on the other end.
Yes. If you had deleted all of your files from one of your machines and then ran Unison, it would delete them from the other
machine. You'd have to actively run Unison.
But you have to actively run rsync, so which Simon did, but just didn't quite understand
all the options. A double whammy of stupidity.
Well, you know, it does seem to happen to some people.
I guess you could call that a backup in some ways, because if you're saying if you're running rsync, say, every 4 hours or so, providing you get in there before the 4 hours, you've still got your files intact.
Well, that's what I do. I don't tend to have a revision-controlled backup system as you would in a large company. At home, I just have my different servers rsync to a box at home. So my data is in more than one place, but it only does it every 24 hours. So if I delete an email that I really shouldn't have deleted and it's gone from my mail server, I've got 24 hours to sort of go in and fish it out and send it back to wherever it wants.
Why don't you look at actually backing up where it only stores the differences, so you don't have like a huge tarball of each snapshot, so you're only keeping the difference or the deltas of the actual changes of files?
Yeah, I could get a tape changer as well, and I could, you know, set up a huge piece of complex software.
So what software would you suggest if someone wanted to do it in a basic way? If someone wanted to back up only the changes from yesterday to today, have a very low impact, low cost backup solution?
I'm actually a big fan of rsnapshot. The only thing I don't particularly like is the configuration file. I mean, this is all console-based stuff, but the configuration file is actually based on using whitespace tab for it to actually work correctly, which is just bad. But it actually works really well. You run it as often as you like, and you can keep as many backups as you want. So you can keep a number of hourly ones, you can keep a number of daily, a number of weekly, a number of annually ones.
So it gives you all these in separate files?
Yeah. So it actually uses a thing called hard links, where it's actually a pointer to the file, similar to a shortcut or symlink. But if you delete one, the other one's still intact. If you change a file, it still keeps the other one intact.
Oh, I see. Okay. So that's how it only does the differences, essentially.
Yeah, because what it does is it actually copies the previous revision, the previous backup. Then any files which have changed, it breaks the hard link to the actual disk, and then replaces that.
So rather than being a client side system, which you often have like a agent that monitors what has and hasn't changed and tells the backup software that's what you should be backing up, this still backs everything up. It just uses a little Linux file system trick to avoid wasting your disk space.
Yeah, and it's actually really, really efficient.
And you run it like regularly, like hourly, daily, weekly, monthly, or something like that, and you end up with multiple backups.
Yeah, and it also
spread over a period of time.
Yeah, and it also deletes the ones. So just say you only want to keep 4 hourly ones, and then the last one will be changed into a daily one, and then the other ones will get deleted as you keep running it.
Okay, so if I do something stupid and I realise that within a matter of minutes, I can use one of the hourly backups, but if I don't realise it until midway through the next day, I could use one of the daily backups to get that file back or something.
Yeah.
Is that why?
Sure. I mean, I had a client recently that lost something 3 months ago, and it was just easy to find because it's the same file structure. And you just say, there's your file. You know, it's really easy just to locate it because it's the same.
Okay, so basically you just install rsnapshot and then configure it with this funky configuration file that's in etc and then run it regularly and it backs up on a regular basis. And that's it. You don't have to do anything else.
Yeah, you just leave that running in the background. It's basically, it's based on rsync. So anything that rsync can do, it can do. And yeah, you just run it and leave it.
And where would you back it up to? Do you back it up on the... So let's say your average home user is running a desktop PC or a laptop. Where do they back up that stuff to? Do they back it up to a USB hard drive? Do they back it up to a remote server? What do they do?
It has to be somewhere that's not on that system.
But redundant as well. So you want something with at least sort of 2 hard drives. So if one of them hard drives dies, you're not going to lose everything. Back to the redundancy argument.
Are we not talking overkill for your average home user? Yeah, your average home user doesn't have oodles of disk storage and mirroring.
The trouble is you need to. I mean, okay, admittedly, there needs to be more GUI tools out there. But the main thing I struggle with is the fact that people are using digital photos now.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
And video.
And video. So, you know, you lose that, and you could lose your entire child's...
But are you not looking at masses of bandwidth to get your, you know... But 4 gigs of photographs to
if you're copying to a remote location. Yeah. But if you're copying to a USB hard drive or something else that's on your network,
like a drone.
Yeah. Well, okay, all right. I'll tell you what I do. I have my desktop PC, my laptop, and I've got multiple laptops, and they all run a piece of software that's in the repository called Backup Manager. And when you install it, it asks you where you want to back up to. And I happen to have all my Drobo mounted for all of my machines on /media/Drobo. And there's a folder on there called Backups. So basically all I do is tell Backup Manager when I install it to back up to Drobo/Backups. And I end up with a backup every day. Job done. And there's a, okay, there's one option I change. By default, it backs up the whole of your home directory and your etc directory into that backup location, but I change one line from tarball to tarball incremental, I think. There's one line I change, and that means that on a Saturday it does a full backup of every machine, and on every other day during the week it does an incremental backup, if they're switched on, of course.
Wow. And the full backup presumably, you know, takes a long time to copy if you've got gigs and gigs of data.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, I've got stupid amounts of data in my home directory. You know, I've got music and movies and VMware images or, you know, virtual machine images. So, yeah, there is a stupid amount of data, but luckily I have quite a big chunk of space in my Drobo. So, yeah, that works.
Yeah, so I mean,
I could do the same thing with our snapshot that you were saying.
Well, I suppose the difference is with our snapshot, you're actually pulling it mostly. You actually have run it from the server, whereas you're actually pushing it to the storage thing, aren't you?
Yeah, only because in my instance, the Drobo is dumb and it doesn't have any intelligence, and I have to throw stuff at it rather than it have some kind of agent pulling stuff from my desktops.
But I think the thing we're getting to is people are running more, what effectively are servers in their own house than they were 5 years ago. I mean, even Microsoft has come out with a home server, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is what things are going to go with the digital age. Oh, I hate that phrase. But yeah, I mean, I think that's where
totally. I mean, one of Claire's friends came around the other day with her. She's got a Dell laptop running Windows XP. Okay, it's not Linux, but you know, but indicative of this problem, she came around and it had blue screened every time she booted it up. And the biggest thing she was worried about was not, you know, this machine is blue screening, but I've got a 2-year-old daughter and all my photos are on there and I've got no backup. And, you know, while I could berate her and say, well, you should back up, the fact is that this person is really concerned because she has a potential to lose all the most important thing.
But you've got to do
her.
You've got to do it before you actually put the effort into learning about backups.
But do you actually learn after the first time, really? Well,
no, because this is the third.
Exactly. I know I've done it. And
yeah, we've all done that, and we realise we've lost some sort of priceless file or something, or unrecoverable file, and your heart sinks, and you try to work out how long it's going to take you to recreate it from scratch.
But the most important thing is to make
where
sure...
Where else did I copy it to? Is it out there on the net somewhere? Or, you know, all those kind of things go through your mind, and then you realise that, oh no.
But the most important thing is to make sure you don't tell anyone, because then they'll know you messed up.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so, we're geeks, and we can back up using command line tools like rsnapshot, and I use Backup Manager, and it needs a bit of console-based configuration. But what about your average user? What can they do that enables them to back up their essential data? Let's say they go out and buy a USB hard drive. What can they do?
Well, I think at the simplest level, just dragging and dropping it onto there is, you know, you've actually got a separate copy somewhere, haven't you, at the simplest level?
Mm. Before I bought the Drobo and I set up this rather convoluted, complicated backup scenario, I used to just back up the digital photos and give the DVD to DVD. I just burn them onto a DVD and give them to my father-in-law, and he takes them over to his house.
Buries them in the garden, 10 paces away from the apple tree.
Have you been spying on my father-in-law?
Well, I mean, the USB hard drive is the simplest option, and they're quite cheap to get hold of these days. You have 500 gigs for £50 or something like that. And if there are tools that will help you get revision control on there,
I'm not sure you even need that, really. I mean, so long as you've got enough capacity on that hard drive to just drag everything over. I would think the vast majority of people are concerned about the here and now, what my system looks like right now. They don't necessarily care about a file that I had 3 years ago and, oh, I need to be able to recover that. It's more, oh dear, my laptop has gone kaput and all my photos are on it.
The trouble is then you end up with multiple text files where you're not sure which is the most current one. So you got, you know, you might have a letter or something like that, and you don't know which is the actual one.
I'm not saying you have multiple versions. I'm saying if you connected if you did exactly what you said just now, you plug a USB, brand new USB hard drive in, and you just highlight everything that's in your home directory, and you drag it in Nautilus over the icon for USB hard drive. There you go. Job done. Backup. Isn't that enough? That's a starter for 10, surely.
Yeah, you've backed everything up. But what about backing up your backups?
Well, buy two of them. They're not that expensive. Yeah. Buy two of them, give one of them to someone else, and then every so often you swap it and copy the latest one.
Yeah, it's a bit of a pain, though, that really is.
Yeah, I know. Backups are a pain. They're a pain. Absolutely a pain.
They're a pain. That's why people don't do them.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why I get phone calls from people saying, oh, I've lost all my photos because my laptop is blue screening and I haven't got access to that stuff anymore because you didn't back up. And the reason you didn't back up is either because you didn't know you should or you knew you should and you didn't do it.
So what do you think you'll be looking at, Simon?
Learning how to use rSync. Actually, because that's what I'm trying to do.
Dude, I have an option for you. Dropbox. It is just super. It's super, super, super.
Go on then. What's it about?
Right. Dropbox. It's a cross-platform. Windows, Mac, Linux, I think. And you go to their website, you download the thing, and you put it on your Linux machine, okay, or your Windows machine or whatever. And you get a little icon on the toolbar, and it... also creates a directory in your home directory. So on Linux, that would be your home folder. You get a folder called Dropbox. And if it was a Windows machine, it would be in My Documents, Dropbox. Mm-hmm. Whatever you put in that folder gets synchronized up to a website, this Dropbox website. Mm-hmm. If you then install Dropbox on any other machines, now they could be other Linux machines, Windows machines, could be a server, anything you've put in that folder will automatically get synchronized to those other machines.
Sounds quite simple, doesn't it?
It's amazingly brilliant. Claire has the use of at least three machines here. She's got her Asus EPC, my Dell laptop, and the desktop. And I've put Dropbox on all three of them. And she can just put files in Dropbox, and it's synchronized across all three of them.
You make Claire sound like a real geek.
She's not. That's the great thing. She isn't. She just has this folder called Dropbox, and anything she puts in there, she knows will appear on the other PCs at some point.
So is it command line based?
Nope. Drag and drop. You just drag the files into that folder, and then you get a little synchronize icon, and it synchronizes.
So how would it work on a server? You said it could be used on a server.
If you're a server-inclined person, there's a little daemon that you can run.
Okay.
But so obviously Claire isn't a server-inclined person, but... Yeah, if you were a server-inclined person, you can put it onto a server and you're laughing.
But then the other factor comes out. This is a private company that they could turn around and start charging.
They could, will. I'm sure they will.
I haven't read the terms and conditions, but they very well could. But also, you're entrusting a third party with your data. I mean, how do you know about their data security?
Well, you read their privacy policy on their website.
Well, no. I mean, how do you know that they're not going to come up with a big gaping vulnerability? I mean, that's something that concerns me.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. So maybe you encrypt your data before you plop it in the Dropbox directory. I mean, you know, you could do that. And in the latest version of Ubuntu, there is a facility to very easily encrypt data in folders.
What I can't understand is using, basically what the developers use is version control tools. Some of them might have heard of them as BZR and SVN, and probably the most common ones at the moment. Why not? I mean, how hard would it be to reproduce Dropbox?
Oh, yeah. I would love it if there was an open source version. If there was a completely open version and I could run my own Dropbox server and synchronize, you know, automagically. Yeah, I'd love it. And I wouldn't have to pay for it. And it would be, yeah, marvellous.
Well, I was actually looking into it this week, and it actually would be very easy to do on Linux with the use of Fuse. But this thing called Fuse isn't available on Windows and Mac. Ah, no, it's not available on Mac now, but not Windows.
Yeah, well, there is an open source thing. It is called iFolder. It does the same thing. It's just that it doesn't work. It hasn't been developed. And
there is this magical thing that doesn't work.
Yeah, and it's obviously not as simple as that, because you have to deal with kind of file conflicts and things. If you've got a laptop and a desktop and you both create a file of the same name at the same time, then, you know, how does it work out which one it wants to keep and deploy?
I mean, talking about Dropbox, it has a web-based tool, so you go to their website and you can see what files are put where, and it even keeps old versions of your files, so in the event that you delete a file, you still can get it back.
There are quite a lot of options then.
In summary, what options does a user have?
We've got everything from a USB hard disk through to multiple redundant off-site servers with incremental backups and file level based restore
and iFolder that doesn't work
and everything in between, including things that do and don't work and that may require you to give all your data to a private company. It's a bit of a minefield, really, isn't it?
Just do something. That's the important thing.
Yeah.
Don't leave it until you lose all your stuff.
John O'Bacon, community manager for Canonical, has announced the new sponsorship process for the next Ubuntu Developer Summit coming up in December. Ubuntu developers and other interested parties wishing to apply for sponsorship covering travel and accommodation should apply online before September the 25th.
What is UDS actually about then? I mean, what's the big deal with asking people to say, pay me to go?
Well, it's not paying to go, it's sponsorship, because they want to get the right people at the Developer Summit.
It seems like quite a fair way to do it, because you know, people who perhaps haven't got as high a profile as other people in the community can just stand up and say, yeah, I've done this, this and this, and I'd like to come along and contribute.
Yeah, it makes total sense, really. Yeah.
As Intrepid Ibex pre-release testing ramps up, Jaunty Jackalope is announced as the name of the next release, 9.04.
What is a jackalope?
I thought it was a rabbit
with horns.
It's a hollowed out
pumpkin, isn't it?
It's a hollowed-out rabbit with antlers.
So listeners, what the hell is a jackalope?
Please write in and tell us what the hell a jackalope is.
Podcast at ubuntu-uk.org. The much-talked-about dark theme for Ubuntu is now being tested under 8.10. The New Human theme uses darker colours for window decoration with tangerine accents for quite a classy look, actually. Whilst it's not as dark as the existing Ubuntu Studio theme, it's certainly a departure from the mainly brown themes from previous releases.
Not that I have an issue with brown. I quite like brown.
I don't like brown.
It'll be too dark.
It is quite dark, actually. I run Ibex.
There's some bugs. But generally, I'm actually getting used to it.
Oh, I'm getting used to it, but it's still dark. It's still quite, you know.
Is it a bit more Mac OS X-y sort of?
No. Because Mac is, you know, it's very shiny metal, brushed metal, isn't it? Mm. And this is, I mean, if you think Ubuntu Studio and think more dirty, I think.
Dirty?
Dirty Studio.
Dirty Studio 904.
I guess it's fair to say it's a little bit rougher because Ubuntu Studio go for a very polished look, and I think they've purposely gone for a slightly rougher look, so I can see why you say that. But call it dirty. Well.
Do you want to see my dirty theme?
I've got a dirty theme.
Dirty Ubuntu.
The BBC-developed open-source codec, Dirac, has reached version 1, and VLC, which is the open-source media player, which now includes support for Dirac, has also had a version bump too.
So do you think anyone's going to use Dirac?
Well, when the BBC starts to use it, other people will, I think.
I'm not convinced the BBC will actually use it. It's an R&D project, but, you know, are they actually going
to
use it?
Have they actually just done it to keep Derek employed?
Poor old Derek. Derek's only gone to version 1 now.
Well, version 1 would presumably mean it's stable.
Yeah, that's true.
Derek is quite stable.
It's a free format, so it's all good.
Prominent kernel hacker Greg Carr-Hartman hit out at Canonical this week in his keynote at the Linux Plumbers Conference. In it, he asserts that Canonical don't contribute patches to the kernel and that developers who work for such companies should leave. What do we think about that?
I think it's a tad harsh.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the slides, it's just a barrage against Canonical, really.
And that's not really what you expect from a keynote, to be honest. You expect a bit more inspiration from
and positive. It was very negative.
Doesn't he work for Google now?
No, Novell.
IBM released a beta of their Lotus Symphony Office Suite for Ubuntu. Based in part on openoffice.org and with support for ODF file format, IBM have given us another alternative to Microsoft Office.
Did we need another alternative to Microsoft Office?
Linux is made of alternatives.
Yeah, choice is a good thing, apparently.
Choice between two or three Office suites that don't quite do everything you need.
Harsh.
Well, would it not have been better to put a lot more effort into improving OpenOffice.org, or were there reasons they couldn't do that? The people behind Wine, that's the program that lets you run Windows applications under Linux, have released a packaged version of the new browser from Google. So Crossover have taken a Windows build of Chromium, which is the open source browser Google Chrome is based on, and packaged it with Wine to make it run on Linux.
So it's open source and it's not native.
Yeah. I know, it feels dirty. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, that's as dirty as your desktop. I just want to wash my hands.
Yeah.
We've had over 50 entries to the competition, which is great.
So we picked the winner, and it is Adam Spain.
Well done, Adam. And you've won £200 worth of Bitfolk hosting, which is essentially a VPS for a year, or you can use it against a cheaper option or more expensive option and put in a bit of extra cash yourself. So we'll email you those details, and I hope you enjoy your prize. Do you want to start another one?
We mentioned in the news that Crossover, the people behind Wine, have released Google Chrome for Linux. And we thought we'd run another competition for a Canonical store voucher and have the question,
what does Wine stand for?
Send your answers, please, to competition@ubuntu-uk.org by Wednesday, the 1st of October. We spoke about Intrepid Ibex in the last episode. I suggested that alphas should be aimed at users, and the new crack that's in that release, be it an alpha or not. Whereas you guys all said, no, it's all about, it's an alpha. It's about finding bugs and fixing them. And actually, as I said, I would on that Monday, installed it, and I found a bug.
Whee! Excellent.
My Yay. First. So it was good. A good learning experience, and I filed a bug.
Even better.
There's been some feedback, and it's been patched, and it's fixed. So,
Awesome.
However.
Oh, dear.
Well, it's the first experience of it, and it went quite well, actually. But a while back, maybe 6 months ago, a certain person we all know suggested that we should be working on 5 bugs a day. Everybody, pick 5, work on them. Do something to move the bugs along. Nah, that's far too difficult.
Do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
What makes it difficult? First of all, clarify what 5 bugs a day, 5 a day is. 5 a day is not necessarily go and find 5 bugs and work on them and fix them. 5 a day is there are a boatload of bugs out there. Like Ubuntu has metric tons of bugs filed against it. Some of them are good bugs in that they consist of useful detail, but some of them are just make this work and have no detail whatsoever. 5 a day is not just fixing them, it's finding, you know, filtering them and
sure,
and
it's working on them to some degree. Yeah. Pick 5, triaging and do them. Something with them.
Yeah,
absolutely. But
and why is that so hard?
It's hard because most are deep software bugs.
Yeah,
the ones you speak about, you know, this doesn't work, fix it. Sure, but you almost need a bugs for beginners filter.
Yeah, you do.
So that I could, you know, pick out such bugs and do something with them. But as it is, I have not a chance.
Okay, I started doing 5 a day a week ago, and I'll be honest, the reason why I'm looking at 5 a day is it was triggered by this post that Jono put out about getting UDS sponsorship. So, you know, part of the UDS sponsorship was start working on 5 a day. So I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll start working on 5 a day. And on the first day, I actually found 5 bugs that I could do something with. Now, some of them were pretty basic and were, for example, there was someone with a graphical problem. And I said, post your Xorg log file. And I gave the path to the log file.
Okay, so it's really quite a simple thing. You don't necessarily have to resolve anything. You can just ask for more information or identify as that's a duplicate of some other bug. Or
that certainly helps in some cases, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of bugs. No application assigned to them. They're not assigned to a particular package, so they're just assigned to Ubuntu.
Right.
And obviously that's not going to help necessarily. I mean, it's good that they've reported that bug. That's great. But it needs to be put into the right pigeonhole for the people who work on that part of Ubuntu to be able to pick that up and then work on it.
So that's the triaging stage, yeah?
Part of triaging is assigning it to the right package, yeah. So whether that means assigning it to Xorg or whatever application it is that's crashing or whatever. And some people do have a good go, you know, when they report a bug, they do try and assign it to the package and maybe they get it wrong.
I think one of the most useful things is actually just trying to reproduce a bug and whether you can reproduce it and confirm the bug.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I had that earlier on this week. I had a bug with something and then asked Dave if he could confirm it because I knew Dave was running Ibex and I said to him, Dave, mate, can you install this program and run this and does the same thing happen for you?
Yeah, hang on. We're getting away from the point. The point is find 5 bugs a day and work on them. Now, we're not users. I work hard and I could sit there for an hour and not find 5 that I could possibly work on.
I think you'd be surprised. I think if I sat next to you and we went through until we found one is enough.
I've tried on numerous occasions and it is too difficult.
So, I mean, what someone initially asks is, Alan, do you think it's, you know, I mean, have you been able to keep to the 5 a day?
No, because not because I can't find 5 a day necessarily, but I can definitely, you know, do a fair few.
Yeah, but I totally see Simon's point. If you are willing and eager to try and do 5 a day, where do you start? You just click on random bug until you find a bug that you can, look at? Or do you particularly look at a particular bugs in a particular area or a particular package that you happen to use or be reasonably familiar with and look for open bugs that are unconfirmed?
The good thing is there's documentation that helps you. There's a wiki page, which is wiki.ubuntu.com/5-a-day.
If 5-a-day is manageable, why have in the last 7 days only 35 people have actually submitted bugs to the 5-a-day project?
Had you been submitted
as
bugs?
In 35 users have actually said, I'm working on 5-a-day and submitted the bug number they're working on.
How'd you measure that?
From Daniel Holbach's 5-a-day stat page.
Okay. Well, I haven't done any today because I spent most of the day in the pub.
But what I'm getting at is, I mean, the Ubuntu community is vast. Why in the last 7 days is there only 35 people
because
that are working
it's
on
too
it?
It's not that hard.
No, it's not. It really isn't that hard.
But if it was a bug a day, do you think it'd be more interested?
Probably not, because as I've said before, it's finding something you can do.
Well, okay, Simon.
If I don't have the application, I've never run the application in my life, and in fact, I've looked at this bug and thought, that's interesting, I'll install that, and I actually install the program that the person's having a bug with, and then try and do what they do, and find that it fails, all I've got to do is go, yep, confirm. Yep, I get that problem as well. That's not hard.
No, it's not, but for a lot of those things where you're just asking further information, you know because of your experience for the right information to ask for. You know which log file to ask them to post or the output of LSPCI or...
Yeah, but the only reason I know that is because I've been doing it for a while.
Exactly. So
and
when
so you've got to start somewhere.
You've got to start somewhere. Yeah, okay.
So okay. And the 5-a-day gives you links to how to diagnose Xorg problems, how to diagnose sound problems. So every Xorg bug that comes in, or some of the Xorg graphical problems that come in, I point people to the wiki page, Xorg Debugging, and say, could you please get the Xorg log file? So it's not like I have some deep innate knowledge of Xorg. I don't. I really, really don't. Okay. I'm not even a developer. I can't read C. I've never written a program in the last 15 years. So it's not like I'm really deeply, a geeky developer.
Okay, do you think one of the problems is the bug reports aren't useful enough insofar as when someone reports a bug, you could say... you give it a title, you say what project you think it's attached to, yeah? And then you've got a big wide text box where you actually say, this is the bug. Do you think it'd be better if it was more restricted to, and that people had to say how to reproduce the bug? And then someone who doesn't have to be an advanced user at all can say, okay, click file, load, and then it crashes. Yep, okay, that does the same to me. And that is a big help to the actual developers of the thing.
Have you used a Launchpad recently? It actually has a thing that says, please enter the steps required to reproduce the bug. It actually does ask for exactly that detail.
Well, to be honest, I guess people don't read the detail these days.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that doesn't help. But and that raises another point. People don't read the text when they file a bug. And if they don't read the text and you end up with a crap bug report, then all it takes is for someone who's had, 1 or 2% more clue to help that person and coach that person into making that bug report better and maybe filing more bug reports in the future.
Okay, so that's the bug reporting process in general. What about the whole 5-a-day thing? I got to be honest, when I first heard about it, I thought it was slightly, patronizing and slightly kind of...
over-demanding.
Contrived and pretty over-demanding as well. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Launchpad. I've not used it all that much. I'm sure it's wonderful if you're into it, but I'm certainly not somebody who goes through looking for new bugs and or doing things to bugs in there anyway. So never mind setting myself the target of doing 5-a-day. Doing sort of anything on Launchpad is would be a step up for me. But to be said, why didn't you all? You're not contributing properly if you're not doing 5 bugs a day.
That's not what they're saying. What they're trying to do.
Well, hang on. They're saying you stand a hell of a lot better chance of going to UDS if you're doing 5-a-day.
No, I didn't say that. I basically said, in Jono's blog post, it basically says, yes, we look at your 5-a-day, but that's not the only thing. That's a metric, a way of determining what contribution people have made to Ubuntu. There are plenty of other ways to measure what people have done.
Okay, but does the scheme have, does it have merit? If you've got 30 people or whatever it is that are actually doing 5-a-day in the last day, that's great, but from a community the size of Ubuntu, That doesn't seem all that spectacular to me.
Well, I would question the stats that Dave got. I don't know where he got that from. And, you know, what's your stat? Okay, we're looking at... Yeah, I know where that is, but where's the number?
Okay, I'm looking at the top 50 in 7 days, and it only lists up to 35, which leads me to the conclusion that only 35 people submitted in the last 7 days.
Yeah, so what if someone submitted 5, 8 days ago? And then didn't do anything for a week.
Won't show on that because I...
Yeah, exactly, that's
said,
my point. What if 100 people... What if 100 people didn't do anything for a week and then they...
And they're not doing five a day. Five a day, not every month.
It's not a case of you must do five a day. It's trying to encourage people to do five a day to try and improve the bug stats.
But I specifically said in the last 7 days, only 35 people contributed towards the five a day.
What's your point?
But I mean, 35 people in the whole Ubuntu community is naff all.
And there would probably be a significant number of those who would have done five a day anyway, because if they're that heavily into it.
Okay, let's look at the other stats. In the last month, there's something like 1,600 bugs.
Yeah, and if you look at one user, one user in the last 7 days has had 354 of them. That's huge. That's more than five a day. I mean, today...
Absolutely.
That's 115.
And that's great. That means that different people do different amounts. That means that you don't have to all do five a day. Some people could do one. Some people could do 100. But it's not about everyone being forced to do five a day.
Why call it five a day?
Well, hang on.
It's a target.
This is meant to be easy. If you're going to make it five a day, they have to find some way of making people like me being able to contribute. I'd love to do five a day. Make it easier so it's easier to find things that I can deal with.
Have you been to the five a day page? Because the five a day page does show a list of all bugs reported yesterday, a list of all bugs that don't have a package assigned to them, a list of all bugs that were reported by Appport. So it's easy to find low-hanging fruit. It really is.
But the thing is, I don't think Simon's necessarily talking about that. I think it means the whole bug process. You know, it's really hard to get into the bug process.
Okay.
I mean, Simon, you're a clever bloke.
Yeah. That's the point.
And you're eager, but you don't know where to start. Now, you know what we need? We need a bug jam. We need a UK bug jam.
But there's plenty of documentation that details exactly how to do this.
Yeah, you know what? That's reading. I need somebody to
over. Oh, that's far too hard for you to read.
It can Well, it's documentation.
It's boring.
Just because it's documentation doesn't mean
it makes
sense.
You can't bitch and complain that it's too hard and I can't do it and I don't know how to do it when there's quite clearly fully documented how to do it and what to do. You can't say, oh, I don't know how to do this and there's no way I can figure it out because it's far too hard. Yet there's a website that tells you exactly how to do it.
Just because of the website doesn't mean it's easy for everybody. Just because it's on the website doesn't mean it makes sense.
It's true with things like packaging as well. I mean, I've watched the tutorials on how to do packaging. I've been to the Ubuntu classroom sessions and they talk all about how to do packaging. Get this and deb dip, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't mean I actually understand it. I could just sit down and do it. I would still need somebody to hold my hand through that process.
Yeah, but if you did it every day.
I can ask you
If I did it every day, but I'm never going to get to do it every day. If I don't get to do it once, I need somewhere to start. I'd need to start packaging on something and get one running and then it to be installable and go, woohoo, it's installed.
Okay, well, we're deviating away from bugs. Bugs is easy to do once a day.
Yeah.
Well, packaging is not easy.
Well, no, hang on. There is something
day.
I want to say is what's the point? Because, I mean, same as what some people must think when they report a bug and it doesn't get looked at, they think, well, why'd I bother reporting this bug? I've got the same thing about packaging. I got it.
Deviating away from bugs.
Yeah, well, this is important. I got a package into RevU, which is where the packages get looked at, and I got this in over a week, I believe it was, before the freeze. Yeah, so I was really hoping it would get into the next release. Hasn't been touched even since. What's the point in putting this work in when no one's looking at it?
Well, that's exactly my point. You've got people complaining that it's too hard to do and that I can't do it. And I've said, well, there's documentation there that explains how to do it. And you're saying, well, nobody's looking at it. Well, that's what we're trying to encourage people to do, is to look
at
it.
No. It's the hierarchy thing, because the people in the know, aren't doing maybe there's not enough of them. I don't know. Yeah. But the trouble is there's more people coming in which are inexperienced users, and they can't...
I think my point, although I was using packaging as a parallel, I think it's still valid. If you have never used Launchpad before and you just don't know how the basics of it work, you kind of need a bit of guidance. And there may be documentation, and it may be fantastic documentation, but who wants to sit and read 80 pages of documentation? And I know, I realise it's probably less than that in real life. I'm exaggerating.
Okay, so let's make something up first, just so I can make a point. Is that what you're doing?
No,
you're making up that it's 80. But, well, clearly, what's the point in saying it's 80 pages worth of documentation when it's one page?
Okay, it's like you said, Ubuntu had a bazillion bugs. It doesn't have a bazillion bugs. Yeah, it has a lot of bugs.
Over 270,000.
Which is not a bazillion. Tony said 80 pages, so he's over-quantifying, which is what people do when they're trying to say a lot.
Yeah. Documentation, although it's helpful for some people, can be intimidating. We've all been on mailing lists where somebody's asked a question that has already been documented on a wiki somewhere, and they haven't found it. Or they
so
haven't
how do
looked.
They make it easier, then?
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure I have an answer. But
there's videos. There's documentation. There's classroom sessions.
How long does it take you to do five a day, if you were to do five?
I do some of them on the train. Actually, I've never timed it.
Are you talking an hour? Are you talking 3 hours?
Probably. I mean, you just work. I just work it into my
It's
going
to vary,
schedule.
Obviously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It depends on how. And some of them are quite easy to triage. Some of them are quite hard, and I have to install packages and reboot into a different version of Ubuntu to do it.
We've had some feedback from our listeners, and Laura's going to read some of those out.
Andrew Robertson says, I love the show. It's the best Linux podcast now that Lug Radio is dead. Keep up the good work. Liam Greenhughes says he's enjoying the podcast and keep up the good work. Nice show, says Mark from Hamburg. Dean Evans from New Zealand says, Hi guys, I've just finished listening to episode 13 after downloading Ubuntu UK podcast for the first time. Love the show, will definitely continue to listen.
Excellent.
Daniel Homeland particularly approves of the creative use of non-restricted music. Seb says, thanks a lot for your fab podcast, really good. From Jason, hello, great show, only one criticism. Occasionally some of the features or interviews go on a little too long.
Oops.
I'm pointing the finger at features like the open mapping feature. Fascinating stuff, but too much of a good thing and all that.
Yeah, I agree.
Pickle says, hi. Hi, Pickle. Matt Daubney, a previous competition winner, says, Mr. Davey, when can I collect my Viglin? I'm back.
Ah, now this is a fine question. Now, which episode did we give that Viglin away? Was it episode 7?
I thought it was episode 4.
Sorry, right? when did we give the shuttle away?
Yeah, that was quite early. So let's have a little rundown of the prizes we're supposed to have sort of sent out. Obviously, the vouchers, email, they're easy to do. So we had the shuttle. I'm just getting a look that says maybe even the vouchers. Vouchers are not all that easy to do. Right, okay, so maybe we're one behind. But say the shuttle that we gave away really quite early on, I think episode 5, 6, something like that. So that will have gone off in the post quite a long time ago, won't it, Alan?
We're now on episode 15.
We're on episode 15.
But hang on.
I can see it. It is sat on the workbench over there. So we're very sorry to the winner, whoever that was. We will get it out. Shooings have been issued in the right places, and it will come into the post.
To be fair, we did get round to working out how much the postage would be
tonight
before we recorded this evening.
Yeah, so we now know how much it's going to cost to ship it to out of Mongolia. Or
so it was never an excuse.
And Pot and Kettle over there, Dave, the Viglin.
Is in the post?
It was in the post again. When did it go in the post?
Today, by his request. He wanted it on Monday because he's between houses.
Didn't he want it about 2
Yeah,
months
so
ago.
He probably wanted it when he won it.
I've got IRC logs.
Have you really? I've got a server. Woohoo.
We know when he won it.
Yes.
Okay, and finally, Ian Lane rather over-enthusiastically entered the last competition with, Howdy, folks. Oh, God, I hope I win.
Oh,
tough. Which is,
like, yeah.
Which is great. I'm glad people enjoy our competitions.
Yeah, hopefully, he'll be able to find some hosting that's suitable for him anyway. There were a couple of other emails, one from Silvio Sister, who won one of our previous competitions. I can't remember which one it was, who says, the podcast is awesome. He really likes the good spirit and the jokes. Well, no counting for taste, is there? His only complaint is that the music has grown a little boring and old. Well, it is old, so there you go. It was funny for a couple of episodes, though. Well, we disagree. We still think it's brilliant, and there are still people who really
have it
like
on
the
their mobile phones.
Yeah, and it's spreading around offices around the country.
Particularly in Surrey areas.
Somebody going by the name Ubuntu Diego, I suspect probably not their real name, asks why we don't put the competition questions on the website. He says he's sometimes not 100% sure what the question is. My guess is he's probably not a native English speaker. Well, we have had a couple of requests to do that. Obviously, we like people to download the episode and listen to it. So that's why we don't put the competition question on the website, because you could just enter the competition without listening to the episode. And if you want to win a prize, you have to suffer through listening to us. It's just part of the deal. If you're hard of hearing or something like that, and genuine accessibility reasons why you can't enter the competition, then email the show and we will let you know.
Pat Davila asked us to play this.
Ohio Linux Fest 2008. Columbus, Ohio, October 10th and 11th. Admission is free!
Yeah, so if you're in Ohio or can get there easily, go along to the Ohio Linux Fest. It sounds like fun.
Well, that was a bit feisty. Should we say goodbye?
Like the fawn.
Yeah, bye. See
ya. Yep.
Well, for those that bothered listening to the end of the episode, goodbye and thanks. Yes.
Congratulations for making it this far.
Yeah,
well, you deserve a prize.
Well done in completing the endurance test.
Yeah. And if you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986, the year I was born.
You can also follow us on Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC, or via identica.ca/UUPC.
We're all IRC nerds, and you can catch us at #ubuntu-uk on the Freenode network.
And thanks to the Mirrors, ShowMeDo, BitVoke, and Nafalo, and the rest of the community Mirrors. And between them, they've managed to share out over 100,000 downloads. Well done.
Excellent. Wow.
14 episodes, 100,000 downloads. Beat that, Linux Outlaws.
We are relying on Dave's dodgy scripts to work these steps out.
Shh, don't tell anyone that.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Laters.
Goodbye.